The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. What if ChatGPT is coming for my job? That's a question I hear a lot recently, and I don't think there's ever been a more anxiety-provoking statement. You know, there was a time when it was a lot easier to be less anxious at work. People had more set careers, worked more defined hours, didn't have email, certainly couldn't constantly, instantly compare themselves to everyone else in the world with the gift and curse of social media. That world is probably never coming back, but it creates ongoing challenges for all of us, a fast-moving, pressure-filled, and yes, anxiety-provoking world of work. The pressure can be compounded when you're trying to create your own path, navigate career changes, build a brand, or work with a different brain. I want to help those of us with brains that function differently, who identify as neurodivergent, figure out a version of how to be yourself at work and get valued for it. And so today's guest is someone who helps business leaders of all kinds navigate these issues. She's a marketing specialist and professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, as well as author of the book The Long Game: How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World. Dori Clark is also someone who thinks a lot about how to build a career and how to help other people decide what they really want out of work. She and I had a lot of fun diving into marketing and branding. It took me back, but I think it will be really helpful if you're trying to figure out how to be yourself at work and get valued for it. Plus, Dori has dealt with her own desolate mental health phases, and she shares what she's learned from those moments as it relates to her long-term path and her goals. I spoke with Dori about work culture, the anxiety of constant communication, and the stress and joy of building your own brand throughout a decades-long career. Okay, Dori, I want to start with, I just saw a story from the fabulous Sarah Green Carmichael from Bloomberg Business Week. And it was actually based on a conversation that she had had on the After Hours podcast. And I'm sure you've seen this Microsoft study that shows what people do at work, and people spend 2 days a week, it is, I think, on email and in meetings. And there's a lot of hand wringing in the media and like, oh my God, like this is taking away from work. And Sarah wrote this great article that was like, no, email is actual work for your actual job. And I want to get your thoughts on this. On what email stands for knowledge workers. Like, is it work or is it just a mundane thing that we hate doing and have to do?
Yeah, email is such a perennially fraught issue.
And it really is.
I feel like in a lot of cases, it's really a both and, right? It's true, of course, that email really is important, legitimate work. It's things like, if you're an editor, someone is sending you an article and you have to send them the changes. I mean, that's the core of your work. It's just that email is the vehicle through which it's done.
Right. If you're a lawyer, you're sending documents.
Yeah. So it's not frivolous in any way. You know, certainly some people are spamming you and sending stupid things, but you actually are transacting a lot of legitimately core business. But the thing that I think makes email so problematic, and I fall victim to this too, is what it represents psychologically. It is essentially this haunting sense that you're never done, you're never finished, people always need things from you, and you're never quite measuring up to this pure, clean, minimalist inbox zero that we aspire to. And I think that it's the self-imposed psychological pressure around it that becomes taxing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And of course, you add Slack and Teams to the mix. I think it makes people incredibly anxious, and we get almost caught in a loop of anxiety around it.
Yeah, absolutely. I have done a couple of times, inspired by my friend Laura Vanderkam, who is a devotee of these kind of time tracking experiments. I have done twice experiments where I tracked down to 15-minute increments everything that I did over a month-long period. I wanted to just see what was I spending my time on. And the truth was, the amount of time I spent on email wasn't actually that horrible. It was about an hour to an hour and a half per day, which, you know, assuming we have a 7 or 8 hour workday, which is, you know, not excessive, still isn't a very large percentage of it. But what I did realize was that even though it was a small percentage of the work that I did, it was just a huge part of my psychological burden of work. It was the thing more than almost anything else that just stressed me out.
Really? Why?
Well, I think a big part of it is the human dynamic. Oh, I haven't gotten back to Maura. Oh my God, I have to get back to Maura. She's going to think I don't like her. She's going to think I am ignoring her. Oh, why am I taking so long? And then, you know, you get sort of avoidant. It's like all of that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so Dori, I want to frame up our conversation. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I want to have a conversation that helps to answer a question. I get this question all the time. How do you know when it's safe to be your authentic self at work? You've written about this. And one of the things I want to do, and I want to start with a little bit of your personal take, you have struck me as someone who is totally yourself in your public presentation and how you talk, and you own it. And it is such a piece of you, and you are so phenomenally successful. And I want to know, were you always like this? What was your journey? Or even when I say that, does that ring true to you?
Well, thank you. First of all, I appreciate the kind words. I think that authenticity at work is such an interesting topic because it's become misconstrued in a lot of ways. Sometimes people treat it as a straw man a little bit. Mm. And I think it's worth digging into because on one hand, you have maybe what I would call the sort of facile cheerleaders of like, be authentic, always be authentic. It's so important. And it's like, okay, yes. But I mean, you know, the level of discourse is sort of like, you know, the live, laugh, love sign that people have on their walls. And then on the other side, you have folks who have talked about this. You know, Adam Grant wrote a piece about this, you know, who I love. Jeffrey Pfeffer has written about this, you know, who I also love. And they're like, dear God, don't be authentic at work. No, this is like the recipe for disaster in your career. And, you know, like, okay, what's the truth? Well, actually, what Adam and Jeffrey are talking about is what I would call like super extreme use cases, right? What like the argument that they're holding up is like, oh, well, some people might say, yeah, man, I don't come into work until 11 because the authentic me is a night owl. And it's like, okay, come on. Like nobody's saying like be authentic to the point that you're not professional or responsible, right? Like that's not really what we're talking about. So I think that there is important nuance in this. And where it comes out, and I think that it is important to name, is that yes, of course, everybody needs to be professional and respectful and responsible and all of these virtues of being a good person. But kind of where the rubber meets the road and where it becomes most important for people in their lived experience is not exclusively, but I would say in particular, if you're a woman, if you're a minority of some sort, you may feel a little nervous, not because anybody's being overtly sexist or homophobic or racist or whatever, but just if you're looking around the room and most people are not like you, you're probably a little aware of that.
Yeah.
And so your level of self-scrutiny is just higher. It's just attuned in a more nuanced fashion than if you fit in with the majority of people around you. And so I think that's where authenticity becomes kind of an issue. And I would say the thing that I learned, I wrote a book called Reinventing You, and I sort of articulated it for the first time as I was writing that book. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I remember, you know, now a decade plus ago when Rachel Maddow got hired to be an anchor on MSNBC. And it was very sort of surprisingly affecting for me to see this like super butch lesbian, you know, on TV in this public fashion. And I realized something important, which I think is pretty true, which is that if you look different than most of the people who have come before, it is harder to break in the sense that other people, they just kind of don't see it. It's like, well, until Rachel Maddow did what she did, she didn't look like a news anchor, right? I mean, you know, a news anchor looks like some pretty blonde girl. Like that's not what a news anchor looks like. But the thing was, once she did break in, it was so much easier for her to make a name for herself and to be a star. You know, there's a million interchangeable blonde anchor girls. There's one Rachel Maddow. And in a lineup, almost everybody who followed the news could pick her out far more easily. And so it's an opportunity once you're there. And then, you know, you have the add-on benefit of like, oh, well, now we've expanded people's understanding of what a news anchor or, you know, insert whatever profession is, could be.
Wow, I love that. I think it's really true. And I'm curious also, what role do you think privilege in workplaces plays in being yourself? You know, if you're the quirky boss who's a white guy, is it different than if you're a young Black woman or the only openly gay person on your team?
Well, I think everything is impacted by who we are and sort of where we stand. That's just sort of a universal thing in every facet of life. But the way that I've always thought about this, so I have been, you know, openly gay basically since I was 13.
Wow.
I'd like to think that I sort of had the advantage in sort of coming out, not only of knowing that, I mean, you know, it took a little time for my parents to kind of be okay with stuff, but I knew that, you know, I was not going to get a horrible reaction. Like some people are like, oh my God, my parents might kick me out. Like I knew that was not going to happen, you know? So I had the privilege of being a teenager and being like, so sort of self-righteous the way teenagers are. And I'm just like, well, this is how I am. And you're going to have to get used to it, you know, which they did. But I recognize that on that facet of things, and, you know, I think it's true across many, many other elements, there are people who are in much more precarious situations. And so if I am able to be publicly visible or sort of quote unquote strong in a certain way, I think that's what I should be doing because I know that not everybody else can. So that's a kind of way of using advantages that I might have to help other people, which is literally the point of having advantages.
That's a really good point. And I think that reflects on why it's really important for leaders, for example, to talk openly about mental health because they do have more advantage, they have more influence, they have more juice. And so I think by them stepping up, they give people who maybe don't feel comfortable talking or for whom it could be precarious to talk about a little bit more safety.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Dori, have you managed anxiety and depression in your life?
So yes, although I'm gonna say it with an asterisk, which is that I feel like in general I have, you know, there's good and bad with all of these things, right? But I would say my general disposition is incredibly even keeled, and the advantage of that is that on an ongoing basis, I don't really deal with anxiety and depression. I would say the negative is that I do notice for sure that I have a lot of friends and colleagues around me who are actually able to enjoy things a lot more, frankly, than I am, because
really?
I am so even-tempered that if a nice thing happens, like if a great thing happens, I'm kind of like, yeah, that's lovely. You know, like I appreciate it, but I don't really feel it, I think, the way that some people do. It's just like, it's really stable. And there's the trade-off that comes with it. So that's one way to answer the question. The other way that I would say to answer the question, though, is that for everybody, including people who maybe on an average are very kind of fine, you could say, mm-hmm. there are particular circumstances that have been extremely hard. And I would say that in particular, I think back to a period of time, a couple of years around, I would probably call it especially 2013, 2014 for me, which was right around the time my first book came out. And that was a super, super hard time for me, which I would retrospectively say I was really depressed. I had had a serious relationship breakup. I had had to move states because of it. My cat that I was really, really close to and had had for 17 years died. And I felt like all the kind of rocks, you know, that I had relied on had gone away. And I just felt this enormous sense of anime. And I was really kind of going through things feeling like a zombie. And I did my job, but it was extremely hard. I was crying every day. I think that I was pretty messed up.
How could you not be? Did you go to therapy?
No, I probably should have. And I'm not opposed to therapy. I've done therapy multiple times during my life, but I was kind of a combination of too busy. Like I was traveling so much for work. Yeah. It just felt hard. And also I think it's kind of like, you know how sometimes you're so tired, you can't sleep.
Yeah.
I think my version was like, I was like so sad and messed up. I couldn't even just like figure out how to take a basic action, like find a therapist.
That's a sign of depression, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so interesting that you shared with me your even keeled nature. Your last book was sort of about longer term visioning, career planning, and not being reactive or even so much trapped, you know, by external factors when it comes to your career. And I think that this is really instructive for people who have anxiety, right? Because a lot of us who have anxiety, we're either trapped by what we see as people's expectations of us or standards that we feel we have to meet to be loved and accepted, or by a fear of the future and bad things happening, right? So we're pedaling really fast in hopes that we can stave off both a scary future or people rejecting us or, you know, bad things. And I'm curious what your response is, what your advice is on taking the long view and learning to tune out those messages that are keeping you so focused on, you know, just pedaling and avoiding the next crisis.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, so many people worry about this and have to deal with it. So growing up, my dad was a psychiatrist. And
really?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Although to be honest, he was like a super distant father. So I didn't, you know, appropriately enough. So I didn't really get a lot of, you know, people are like, oh, did he psychoanalyze you? And I'm like, no, mostly he didn't talk to me.
Oh, God.
But that being said, my mother, who actually was very involved, she trained as a psychiatric nurse and then she went on and became a counselor, you know, so it was like this kind of like mental health steeped background in some ways.
Wow.
And anyway, I recognize now retrospectively that a lot of the way that she would talk to me about things, I mean, in some ways, it's almost like this sort of, you know, CBT kind of thing, right? Like a cognitive behavioral therapy sort of thing. And so if I was upset about something, you know, she would always kind of intervene with like, yeah, but do you have all the information or is there some information you don't have? And, you know, you have to be like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, actually, I guess I don't know for sure this, this, and this. And so she'd be like, well, what do you know for sure? Can you actually draw a full conclusion from that? Or, you know, and I'll be like, well, maybe not. And so the answer almost always is like, all right, you know, you can be a little concerned about it, but it's not appropriate to be that concerned about it because you don't have all the facts. Wait until you have all the facts to freak out if you need to freak out. But like, it's inappropriate to freak out if you don't know the whole situation. And I feel like that's just been so very useful.
I mean, that's like great. She gave you balanced thoughts and neutral information.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. The other thing that was sort of impactful in my childhood, just in terms of like the ethos, was that my dad was in AA. He became one of the people that, like, you know, gets like super into AA. And so when I was a little kid, like a lot of our vacations were, all of our vacations really, were like accompanying him to conferences for alcoholic physicians, which is kind of weird.
Whoa.
You know, there would be like AA logos and stuff, you know, like Serenity Prayer, like crocheted on our walls. Like it was like very hardcore.
And you're an only child.
I am an only child. Yeah. Anyway, like anything, I think, you know, people can get like really into AA, and I guess it's better than being really into drinking. So, you know, praise God for that. But a lot of the techniques that they teach, you know, about just basically control what you can control and like don't worry about the rest. Like, that's actually good advice. Like, you know, props for that.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff. The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. More to-dos, less time, and so many tools to keep track of. Doing business can be hard, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You just need HubSpot. Their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: higher quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
So what would you say to someone? I mean, obviously, I think a lot of people are very scared right now. I cannot stop fixating on the IBM. Was it the CEO? Anyway, someone who runs IBM saying that basically, what, like 30%, 40% of the jobs are just going to go to AI, and like, let's accept that. I cannot get over that. I mean, literally, if you wanted to stoke anxiety in a more powerful way, I can't think of one. Layoffs everywhere. How do we take that advice of controlling what we can only control? Do you have advice on how to operationalize that?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly have a particular viewpoint around it for sure. Yeah. I mean, because I think about this too. I mean, you know, you and I are at the front lines of this, Maura. It's not like, oh, those poor cashiers. You know, that's what everybody said for like the last decades. Like, oh gosh, right, the truck drivers and the cashiers, that's who's going out of business. It's like, nope, it's you and me. it's white collar, you know, quote unquote.
Meanwhile, truck drivers are making six figures because they can't find them.
Exactly. So I have personally been thinking a lot about AI and the impact of AI on the work that I do because, you know, creative work, marketing, writing, like that's sort of the sweet spot of what generative AI seems to be doing. And frankly, nobody saw it coming until ChatGPT was released. You know, nobody knew that it had progressed to that point so rapidly. So yeah, I mean, in the spirit of my controlling what I can control, a lot of people, you know, again, in the sort of realm of sort of like, I think quasi-platitudes, people are like, but lean into the human aspects. And it's like, okay, I don't even know what that means because AI is actually really good. Like it's kind of better than humans in some stuff. So I don't know. What I am leaning into at the moment, very literally, I have been spending a lot of time over the past month doing this, is actually getting control of my investments.
Ooh.
You know, I've always tried to be thoughtful about it, I guess. But, you know, like everybody, I kind of, you know, haven't paid super close attention, you know. And so now I'm trying to consolidate all of them in one brokerage. I've got a new financial advisor and am, you know, really trying to be thoughtful about allocations because I realized that much like I feared during the pandemic, like, oh, this could really go sideways. I might not ever make money again if the economy shuts down. It didn't turn out that way, but that was not an implausible fear. I think for AI, I am thinking, gosh, I might not make money ever again. I mean, it's not going to be tomorrow, but in 5 years, the technology is going to be stunning because it's growing at an exponential rate. So I am trying to do what I can control, which is take the money that I have saved now and get smart about how I am deploying it and just raise my game, because I need to protect and utilize those assets. I'm also trying, frankly, to double down on my health and be really vigilant about exercising, doing saunas, which a lot of scientific evidence has shown is really exceedingly good for your cardiovascular health, and lifting weights and things like that. Because frankly, if AI and the AI-powered singularity is coming, one of the most important things we can do is stay healthy long enough so that we can take advantage of some of the amazing medical advances that are going to be coming down the pike. And you don't want to be in such a sickened state that you don't qualify for them. So, I mean, those are things that I can control. Who knows professionally? I mean, the drum that I've been beating for a long time is around the importance of becoming a recognized expert in your field, because there is always going to be a market for the people who are recognized as the best. There's going to be a flight to quality. Now, people might say, but not everyone can be a recognized expert. And that's true. This does not solve everyone's problem, for sure. It doesn't solve society's problem, but it may solve your problem, because most people are not willing to do the work required to be a recognized expert in their field. And if you are, and if you start now and put in the effort to get your ideas shared, to grow your platform and grow your influence, then it means that you are carving out a path for yourself, regardless of the external circumstances, that enables you to protect yourself.
I have so much to say about this. I could not agree more. I have been sort of banging on for years about the importance of trying to own your niche. And I think that in the coming world, the more specific you can be about what you're good at, what you talk about, what you stand for, the better, right?
Yes.
Because this is not going to be a world for generalists. And so I think if you're listening out there and this is sparking in you, like, try to get very specific. I am so anxious, as you know. I honestly think the reason that I am a recognized expert is partially because of my anxiety. And of course, this is part of being an anxious achiever. You know, it's like, I never stop. I mean, I get your newsletters and I'm like, okay, Dory takes it a notch above me. Your productivity is unbelievable. But I think a lot of listeners out there can relate to the fact of doing the work because we're nervous. And that's not always a bad thing, right? I don't want people to be consumed with AI is coming for my job. I can't sleep ever again. I think it's interesting. And I think that it's one of the most valuable things you talk about. So let's go there, even though it's not strictly about workplace mental health. Like, say someone wants to be a recognized expert. How do they start?
Yeah, absolutely. I run a course and community focused on it. And there's really three key components, Maura. And I'll explain all of these, but it's about content creation, network, and social proof. And the reason that these are the important things for people to focus in on, I believe, content creation is basically about how do you make yourself discoverable to other people, right? If you're going to be recognized for your expertise, the people who know you and work with you may think you are the best, but there's always going to be a lot more people who don't know you and haven't worked with you than those who have. So how do you create content that enables those strangers to discover you and say, wow, she's really great? And it could be writing, it could be doing a podcast like this, it could be speaking, it could be videos. You know, there's a lot of different variations, but somehow you have to create content. That's number one.
Yeah. How much content? Because here's where the anxiety comes in. People say to me, like, there's always more, like, social media never stops. Like, how do you create boundaries and limits around that?
Yeah, for sure. What I advise people, first of all, is just understand everybody is running their own race. You're going at your own pace. I tell people, you know, if you're starting from zero, do an hour a week, you know, just like create a habit. Becoming a recognized expert and investing in your long-term career development is not at all dissimilar from financial investing, right? I mean, we all know that there is a huge power in compound interest. And so, you know, it matters a lot more if you start when you're 20 and you put away $10 a week, like just investing that over time and making it a habit and doing it every week matters a lot more than suddenly turning 50 and saying, oh man, geez, I need to put some money in. Here's 20 grand, you know, mm-hmm. like the mm-hmm. $10 or $20 per week matters a lot more over time. And so similarly, just having small amounts of time, like you might be busy. It's hard to carve out the habit of doing it, but I'd say like, what can you do in an hour per week? You know, is it one blog post or article? Is it one podcast episode? You know, just find the thing that's attainable and then just keep doing that. And you can build, you know, over time if you start to see momentum or if your circumstances change and you have a little bit more time to spare.
I tell people start, if you want to be a sort of professional expert, like start with LinkedIn. Like,
yes,
become a creator on LinkedIn, post once a week.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic starting point. I mean, just at a really basic level, again, to the point of discoverability, what you're trying to do in the beginning, at least, I mean, sometimes people are like, oh, but you know, how do I get the world to discover me? And the truth is, in the beginning, you're going to see a lot more growth, not from having quote unquote the world discover you. You're going to have a lot more growth from having the people who already know you, but are more distant connections, be reminded of you. Oh, Maura. Oh, I haven't thought about her in a while. She'd be perfect for this. Like, that's what you need. And by doing posts or sharing, it puts you in people's feeds and it makes it more likely that they'll be like, oh, right, her. Let's call her.
Okay. So point two.
Yeah. So point two is about your network. And, you know, everybody in terms of sort of the recognized expert realm of things has their kind of things that they're good at or gravitate to and some of the things that they're uncomfortable with. And so for some people, oh my gosh, they love networking. They could do it all day long. They love people. They love it. You know, other people, especially if they're introverts, especially if they, you know, hide in bathrooms, you know, they may be like, oh, I don't know. So ultimately, you can have the best ideas in the world, but if people aren't aware of them and you don't have other people amplifying them on your behalf, then it's limited, right? I mean, there's only so many people that you know directly that you can share things with. You need amplification. And so taking the time to cultivate a network is really important. And, you know, I want to be clear, a lot of people, again, to the point about straw men, they sometimes say, but I hate networking events. I can't network. And it's like, that's fine. You don't have to do a quote unquote networking event. All it means is you have to find a way to connect with people. Like, find your own way. Like, actually, podcasts, I often tell people, podcasts, or if you do, you know, like a LinkedIn Live series, or if you, you know, write a blog or something, that can be fantastic. You know, my good friend Jenny Blake likes to say that podcasting is her networking strategy.
100%.
Because she's a big introvert. And this is like a forcing function that enables her several times a week. She's having these kind of networking calls with interesting people, but she just happens to record them. That's a great strategy.
You know, blog her and blogging was my entire career networking strategy. And when you create content, you have the excuse to basically call up anybody, including someone you may want to be your client or your future boss, and have them talk about themselves, which, spoiler alert, is what people like to do the best.
They certainly do. Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Maura. It's really true. And I love the phrase that you used, which I often do as well, which is that it gives you an excuse. Because sometimes I think we have kind of a weird understanding in our heads of like, oh, but people will think it's so weird if I call them up, or, you know, oh, they won't want to talk, or blah, 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 blah. And I mean, oftentimes they do anyway, but it helps empower us and make us feel more comfortable if we have that excuse to say, well, I'd love to talk to you and I have this podcast. Will you be on this podcast or whatever it is?
Yeah. Okay. Number three.
All right. Number three is social proof. And specifically what I mean by this is a like psychology term. And essentially it's about how do you telegraph your credibility to other people? Because we all know that people are so busy, they're so frenzied, they're so harried, they're really not going to take the time. Even if they wish they could, they're not going to take the time to sort of vet you in depth if they are not familiar with you. They're just going to tune out. They're just going to say, eh, you know, next. And so we need to, if we want to be successful, find ways of very quickly signaling and telegraphing to people that we are credible and that, you know, we're worth listening to or engaging with. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do this, but oftentimes it's about affiliations that we have that are with entities that are already trusted. So your book, Maura, came out from HBR Press. People have heard of that. They say, oh, that sounds great. She must be pretty credible. Your show's on the LinkedIn network. They say, oh, I've heard of LinkedIn. Oh, wow. They picked up her podcast. She must be worth listening to, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, sometimes people think, oh, but, you know, oh, isn't Maura lucky? She's just got these great affiliations. Well, the key, which people need to understand, is, you know, stuff doesn't just fall in your lap. You go get it. You seek it out. And you have much more agency than you might imagine to be thoughtful about cultivating connections and, you know, finding strategic ways to affiliate with brands or entities. It could be that you have a blue chip client that people have heard of. It could be that you guest lecture at certain universities, but you can seek that out strategically, and it dramatically helps with your perceived credibility.
Social proofing is also something you can do with normal people. The whole theory behind influencer marketing, right, is that people like and trust this person on social media, even if they may not know them. And so they have social capital. If they carry a message, it has weight. And the thing that I loved most about my long career, first in what was called mommy blogging, and then what was called working with influencers, was that people who traditionally were not in the halls of power, through their own content creation and often like just sheer freaking will, became the kinds of people who get invited to the White House. And I literally did that. I would invite people to the White House on behalf of administrations who were mom bloggers.
Yeah, it's so cool.
And so, you know, look, I have to acknowledge my total privilege also playing a role here. It's been a factor, okay? I'm not going to deny that. But the great thing about social media is that it has really made the barriers to entry to influence and being a recognized expert, I think, a lot lower.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, you know, every new situation has its own barriers and obstacles. I mean, you know, the obstacle now, of course, is like, oh, anyone can do it, which means there's a huge amount of noise to surmount.
It's harder. Yeah.
And so people say, oh, but, you know, isn't it like worse because I'm competing with everybody? I'm competing with millions of people. And I guess it's a question of like, well, which devil do you want? Do you want the devil of the small elite group that says, I pick you and not the rest of you, riffraff? Or do you want to have the problem where it's just this freewheeling kind of souk and you're wandering around and like everybody's hawking their wares and, you know, you have an equal ability to get your wares noticed, but it's chaotic and you sort of have to rely on your wits to be able to break through. That's hard and that can be intimidating, but I actually like it better as a circumstance for us because it is, I think, fairer. You know, it's not just a powerful few that are, you know, tapping their buddies from Skull and Bones or whatever. It's an opportunity for people to really show the world what they have if they're willing to be persistent and if they're willing to keep plowing forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I'll close this part out just saying, like, I get rejected in a painful way every single day. And as a really anxious person with a lot of social anxiety, if you had asked me 10 years ago, could you live a life where something you cared about got basically put in the trash every single day, would you be able to handle that? I would have said absolutely not. Like, I'd be like a puddle on the floor. But you build resiliency. And when you really care and you're like convinced, the rejection, it's still smart sometimes, right? But it's like, it's just part of the deal. I don't know. Does that resonate for you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it has to, right? I mean, we all face obstacles and rejections and things like that. And what I see, I mean, you know, it's an interesting vantage point because the recognized expert course and community that I mentioned, I've been running it since 2016 and about 700 people have gone through it. And so I've really been able to see in this very both broad and longitudinal sense what the process is like, not just for me trying to do this and sort of establish expertise in the marketplace, but for literally hundreds of other people who are trying to do it. And what I have noticed as a pattern is that for the people who are less successful, it's often that they experience some kind of rejection at a certain point. You know, they didn't get an opportunity. You know, the editor said no, or the agent turned them down, or, you know, whatever it is, the client rejected their proposal. They sort of take this view where it's almost like the universe has decided, right? Like, oh, I guess it wasn't for me, or I guess it just wasn't right, or I guess I'm just not cut out for this. And what is really fascinating, I mean, I obviously, if I am in communication with folks directly, I really push back on this heartily. But what they're not seeing, what they're not understanding, is that the same vicissitudes are befalling other people, but the other people who are successful are just pushing through, you know, 10 times or 20 times until they're able to get it. And I think understanding that is so liberating, because we have this false narrative that, like, oh, well, you know, she must have done it and they must have just accepted it and kind of welcomed her with open arms. It's a different story for me. And that's really not the case. Almost everybody has these gatekeepers, some of whom are incredibly unqualified, frankly, telling them, no, no, you're not good enough. And it's like, no, you need to just keep plowing. Like, if they don't let you in the door, you climb in the freaking window. That's what you do. And that's how you get successful.
Do you still get rejected or ghosted?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the long game, actually, my most recent book, I literally devoted an entire chapter to this because I really wanted to be clear. Like, sometimes, you know, I've managed to have some successes that I feel proud about and fortunate about. And so sometimes I get people saying, like, oh, well, you know, you've made it, quote unquote, or whatever. And I wanted to really present up close that, like, no, like, no matter how much people might look at that and say, oh, you've attained X, so therefore everything must be peachy from now on. Not the case. And so I picked a year just before the pandemic, so 2019, and I had 5 major goals, kind of stretch goals for myself that year. And so in the book, I describe very methodically how over the course of the year, 4 out of the 5 goals completely blew up. And I mean, just like all the things, right? I had a really famous author in my field who was going to co-write a book with me. We had an agreement, like, all good. I sort of did all the work of having the proposal and stuff. And then this person got $1 million book deal for a different book. And it's like, sorry. It's like, okay, you know, put that one aside. There was a conference that I really, really wanted to get invited to speak at. And I thought it was really close. I thought it was in hand because they took a super long time to get back to me. And I had all these friends who had applied and they kept getting rejected. And I was certainly not glad that my friends were rejected, but I was sort of taking it like, oh, I must still be in consideration. You know, they haven't said no. Nope. Like, literally, we got to like 2 weeks before the conference and it turned out they just ghosted me. They literally never got back to me, but they announced the speakers and I was not a speaker. I'm just like, oh.
Oh, I hate that. I hate when you get the public announcement and you're like, well, I guess I didn't get it.
Yeah. I mean, it was literally all the things. Oh, there was a very prominent media outlet that had invited me to pitch to be a columnist for them. And it was this like limited pool of people. They're like, well, you're under consideration. There's, you know, we're evaluating 5 people. And they strung me along for 18 months. They had me do, I mean, I think I wrote probably like 4,000 words worth of sample columns for them, like just all this stuff. And then
that just happened to me, Dory. Yeah. It was one of the most painful experiences of my life.
Oh, God.
To just feel like a life, like a bucket list, right? Dream is in hand. Mm-hmm. And then to just like literally over a period of many months, like just consistently feel like this is it.
Totally. Yeah. So anyway, they ended up, you know, rejecting me for this thing after all of that time. And I remember writing to the editor and saying, oh, okay, I understand this opportunity won't work out, but I hope maybe there's another possibility for us to work together in a different way. And he wrote back in his message, just like, thanks. Hope you keep reading. I'm like, oh, whoa, burn. So yeah, I still get rejected is the answer. Yes.
Okay, so last question, just to bring this around. If someone's listening and they're really feeling like their authenticity, who they truly are, is so important, it's such a piece of them, but also scary and doesn't feel acceptable at work. What in your conversation and this conversation in your work can inspire them to think about how to turn that into their niche, their superpower, their recognized expert thing?
You know, for a lot of people, whatever your thing is that you worry is different or out of the mainstream, there's a lot of trepidation around it, around sharing that and how you'll be viewed or how you'll be judged. And I like to think about a really wonderful client of mine and colleague and friend of mine named Richard Bistrong. And Richard was somebody I got to know about a decade ago. He first started reading my book when he was in jail. So talk about a thing that someone might worry about how the perceptions are. He had gone to prison for bribery, like corporate bribery, you know, working in a kind of high level job where that was a thing that people did, you know, although they were not supposed to do it. And he got caught for it. And anyway, he read Reinventing You, my first book, when he was in prison. And he reached out to me and we got to be friends. I mean, he's a really terrific guy. And one of the things that he realized and discovered through reading Reinventing You, I mean, he was, of course, thinking like, my God, how am I going to earn a living? You know, how people will judge. That is a thing. But he realized that he needed to take the bull by the horns in terms of his branding. And if he just kept like hiding it somehow or not talking about it, you live your life constantly feeling like, oh my God, people will find out. What will they think when they find out? And it becomes so psychologically toxic. And so what he decided to do, which is what I recommend in Reinventing You, is whatever your thing is that you think is a weakness, lean into it, because people will see that and it can become a strength and people often really admire it. And so in Richard's case, he has been able to literally create a business for himself called Frontline Anti-Bribery. And he is a ethics and compliance consultant for corporations. And he goes around and speaks and does trainings around ethics from the perspective of someone who has been in the shoes of the executives that he's speaking to and saying, hey, you know, I face these ethical temptations. I did the wrong thing. Let me show you how you can resist that and do the right thing. And he's built an incredibly successful business for himself, not by hiding his background, but by going all in with it and making it a point of distinction and differentiation.
Dory, thank you so much.
Maura, it's a joy to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.